Welcome to your episode 219 of the At Percussion Podcast. Today's date is February 16th, and this episode will be released on March 5th. My name is Ben Charles. With me today, as always, is Ksenia Komlenovich.
Hi, Ben.
How's it going, Ksenia? Good job.
I am very excited that you pronounced my last name. Good job. I'll put this in my calendar as a little event.
Also joining us today, we have some of the rotating crew today because some of our regulars are out. We have living composer Brian Nosny with us.
Hi.
As well as Bill Schaltes.
Hello.
Bill, how was your Valentine's Day?
It was great.
Good.
Took the wife out for a nice dinner.
Very nice.
Yeah.
So our guest today is a New Jersey-based percussionist, composer, improviser, and teacher. He's performed regularly in New York City, New Jersey, and Philadelphia as a freelance percussionist. His experience spans contemporary classical music, theater, improvisation, and studio work. He's appeared at the Zeltzman Marimba Festival, the Lincoln Center, and on Gordon Stout's Welcome to Stoutland album. Please welcome our guest today, Anthony DiBartolo.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. So, Anthony, I figured we'd jump right into it. I saw on Facebook that you have a book coming out, and whenever we see someone with a book or an album or something of that nature coming out, we usually like to have them on the podcast. So could you tell us about this book that you have? And I know it's been a years-long process of discovery for you to get into this improvisation topic.
Yeah, I'd love to kind of share a little bit of the backstory of it, but it's because it's kind of one that is important to me. So when I was doing my undergrad, so I guess this was probably in like 2005, what I was doing was I was at my undergrad at Rowan University, which is in South Jersey. And I used to play with like all these jazz majors. And then we started like improvising a bunch, and it would be like a couple of times a month, I guess. We would go into one of these practice rooms late at night, and we would just like shut all the lights out and just go nuts. Like a lot of us would have like I played drum set mostly for that, but sometimes I'd like wheel a marimba in there or like bring found objects. So then some of the classical percussion majors, like along with myself, would come in, and then we would invite other musicians and just go crazy. And you know, I was really into metal at the time. Like I was playing in a metal band, and like, so I just wanted to like kind of make it rock and roll. And then we started kind of like, I guess, throwing a bunch of effects on our instruments, and things started getting even more crazy. But it was just like an eye opener for me, because at that point I was so focused on technique and, you know, trying to learn a bunch of repertoire that it was just a cool time to just be completely free and not think. And eventually we started even recording ourselves so we could go back and listen to it and kind of analyze what we were doing. And, you know, sometimes it was awesome, sometimes it wasn't so awesome, and like, that's all great. So that was like a transformative experience for me. So after that, I really started investigating more improvisation in general, but I would say focused around free improvisation, or, you know, like non-jazz idiomatic improvisation, which is kind of what I characterize my new book as. So that's the early stages. Okay, so about 4 years ago, in 2016, I started doing like a little tour where I would just invite people to improvise with me, or sometimes like I felt like I was really like, you know, privileged to be there with some of these really great players. And it started out with just percussionists. So my grad work I did with Gordon Stout when he was still at Ithaca. And so Gordon and I improvised some bossa nova and some other styles. I had Jason Truding and I, we did a bunch of his pieces together. I had Phil O'Banion from Temple University. And then I started improvising with a bunch of players in this group based out of New York that I was working with, the Glass Farm Ensemble. We did a lot of like aleatoric music and things that even besides Cage, that really didn't have specifics, where we had to, you know, play things that weren't all notated. So at any rate, all this stuff kind of started swirling around in my head, and I figured it's time that we fill the void of, you know, trying to make some sort of improvisation part of our daily practices, no matter what, you know, field we're in. A lot of people, even now, like, they'll ask me if I do a clinic, like, well, why don't we do this for the jazz majors? But, you know, it's not that kind of improvisation, although it certainly could be, and they all kind of go hand in hand. But I think that it's important for especially classically trained players to get the exposure to creating on the fly, whether there's a little bit of structure, like in my book, or if there is no structure at all.
So my follow-up question would then be, so you sort of have this background that's in metal and in classical percussion, and then you had the opportunity to be dragged into the jazz idiom, but you say that, you know, that didn't happen. Could you describe to us what is the framework within which you operate, and why did you choose to go to this non-jazz idiomatic improvisation route?
Yeah, sure. Well, again, like what really inspired me was just a lot of the music that I was playing, where it was more like there were times where it was just text based. It could have been text instructions. It could have been graphic instructions, and then I was pretty free to improvise based on that. And that really inspired me because there was some structure, but not, you know, not too much. Like, it wasn't a written piece that I was like encumbered to learn, right away, and then have to figure out a way to like put my own touch on it. So I wanted to find something in between. And I still kind of consider these, in a lot of ways, you know, it's kind of inspired by contemporary classical music, but it's kind of not. It can be whatever the people who this falls into their lap, you know, is. So I would say that the other thing that inspired me really to go in this direction was, you know, I had a lot of students at the time too that it was constant. Like, I felt like they were just constantly looking to me for, you know, right and wrong. And that's one of the first lines in the foreword of my book is like, you know, I've learned that we really learn music from this perspective that is things are right and wrong. So, and that's great. That's what it's supposed to be. We need to know those things to move forward in our careers. But it doesn't always have to be like you play in time or out of time. You play the right notes, you play the wrong notes. You play the right rhythm, you play the wrong rhythm. Because then it kind of pigeonholes us into constantly being scared to play. And I found a lot of my students were kind of scared to play the instrument. And so I started, you know, pushing some of these etudes on them in the early stages and say, hey, just take a scale and just, you know, try and follow these rhythms, or, you know, look at this, like take this multi percussion setup, right? So like, we'll set up a conga and we'll set up, maybe like some found objects, a cymbal, and follow these rhythms and try and just make something up. So they have a little bit of structure, but not a ton. And I found that, over time, and it took a long time, especially with the high school students who are constantly thinking about, you know, whether or not they're right or wrong, you know, like for them to actually believe me that I didn't really care what they played, you know. And so it was a cool thing for me educationally as a teacher, you know, just to build that rapport and the trust with my students. Like, I felt like they trusted me after that a lot more, so that when I did, in their, you know, marimba literature or snare drum literature, asked me for advice for shaping a line, they knew that it was really a suggestion. It wasn't just that I was telling them, you have to do it this way, but I'm going to pretend like, you know, you don't.
That makes sense. Thank you.
So I'm curious, and you kind of answered what I was going to ask about the idea of, like, so why does it seem that so many people, especially in, for lack of better terms, classical percussion, are scared to improvise? Because I found that same thing, that just you ask someone, not just a percussionist, but a flutist, a violinist, whatever, to improvise, and they're like, oh, I don't really do that. Even when you say, oh, it's, well, we're not talking like jazz, you got to know changes and whatever, but let's just have a conversation through music, and they're really intimidated. I like what you said, the idea of that we're so concerned with, well, the right thing versus the wrong thing. But I also wonder if part of it I'm curious to get your thoughts, if you think part of it as well is the way that, for percussion at least, the way we've started to mold the activity now with a lot of like WGI and DCI, where kids are playing one particular instrument. I know for me, the gateway drug was drum set to get into this, and then playing in rock bands and whatever, where now I'm not, well, maybe I play this fill this night, I play this fill another night and stuff. And so now we start to get people that are, well, I don't play drum set, or I don't play snare drum, I just play marimba, or I just play vibraphone. And nothing against WGI or DCI by any stretch, but I wonder if that's maybe part of it as well, is the moving away from drum set as kind of that gateway drug into percussion.
Yeah. You know, I think about that so much, about how it's kind of built into us as percussionists, right? So even just playing world music, even, like, I studied Darbuka a lot with this guy in Philly, and you know, like, you can't not improvise, right? Even if it's just with the ornamentation and in on the fly, you know, that's part of the style. And yeah, and then obviously, like you mentioned with drum set, you know, we all improvise. You sit down behind the kit and, you know, we know what a basic rock beat is, but then we know that it's stylistically correct to embellish it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I totally understand that. And I think that that's the definitely the scary thing for other instrumentalists that aren't, you know, practicing improvisers, I guess I should say, you know, because they're just never required to do that. And so the one thing that I was doing a lot of research on was actually just thinking back into history and looking at, like, these amazing musicians in the Baroque era, even. Mm-hmm. And, like, they were required to improvise. I mean, it wasn't really a question. So the guys who had, like, I guess, who had all the gigs, you know, like, they all those people were the ones that were great improvisers. So they could kind of, like, improvise the figured bass or actually, you know, improvise a fugue or whatnot. So that also kind of inspired me to just think about more of ways to help people in general get into it. And actually that brings me to one other thing, if you don't mind, that I was just thinking about is with percussionists specifically, I feel like we either have backgrounds doing that, right? We improvise in world music or drum set, or it's like very contemporary, like out stuff where it's graphic notation or it's just text. But there's no real middle ground unless you have a jazz background, right? That, like, more like you have a tune and you can improvise over that. And that's exactly what my book is kind of geared to hit, is that middle ground. Because I think that some people, like the marimbists who never play drum set, are scared to improvise because it's like, well, I don't play jazz. And then I'm afraid of, like, playing with a bunch of shapes on a page, mm-hmm. you know, or right. I'm afraid to interpret, you know, these words, because it's so unfamiliar to me. So my book actually kind of goes in the route where it starts with structure, and then the last etude actually is just text. So it kind of goes from, like, the most structure to the least structure.
Perfect.
If I could, there's so much talk about all this stuff, it's so great, but it reminds me of my music appreciation class that I teach. And it's a fun class, because on the first day, you always have to define what is music. And so I go around the room and I ask everyone, and everyone, you know, these are all non-majors that are just saying something to not get me, you know, jumping down their throat about it. And I listen to everyone's answer. And then at the end of it all, I kind of say, well, the sort of established definition for music types is organized sounds and silences, or structured sounds and silences. And that's kind of all encompassing. And then when we talk about structure or organization, it's like, oh, there's, you know, things like harmony, rhythm, meter. These are how we organize sounds and silences. And then that brings me over to teaching my percussion major students drum set. And we do, so, like, the Morgan book I've mentioned before, but there's a certain degree of improvisation on that. And whenever we talk about improvisation, you know, I always ask them, what does improvisation mean? And inevitably they say, making stuff up. And I say, well, yes, but also not necessarily, because you're working within a certain framework. And last week we talked about Max Roach, and Max Roach would improvise, obviously, but it was always within a certain framework of, you know, okay, this is a bebop tune. Here's the tempo. Here's the vocabulary of that. And I think so much of the fear of improvisation comes from there are certain things that are right and wrong in music. Harmony, for example, there are certain notes that do not belong in a C major chord. Like you should probably not have, I don't know, a C sharp in a C major chord. And there's, I think, a certain fear of that. And what I've noticed about Anthony's book is he sent us a couple of sample etudes to look over so we could sort of understand where he was going with this. But there's a sort of like harmonic framework, but it's also not like G7 chord. Here are the notes of the scale you play over that. Could you talk about how you sort of arrived at that point in your, you know, loose structure that allows freedom, but also isn't so, like jazz chord driven sort of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like a modal approach, right? So like, it's kind of picking one scale and just making that work over a variety of changes, or it could be like looked at as, you know, I'm kind of focused on one chord and seeing what I can do with that one chord. And that's something that really, was inspiring to me, is like thinking about a record, let's say like A Love Supreme by Coltrane, right? If you look at they found the manuscript of that a few years ago, and it was like this just one page structure for that 1 hour of like beauty that they made out of it, right? And it was like very few chords, and the magic that was taken off that page can only be explained by like those musicians at that time. And so that was another inspiration. Like, I remember the first time I heard Bitches Brew and In a Silent Way by Miles Davis, like, again, just like focusing on maybe like an E minor chord was the bass, right? Or like the bass is just like, you know, hanging out on an E for a while, and then they play everything that they did over that. Yeah. And so everything that they played over that was super just free, and it was based on what they were hearing, and not necessarily interactive, I guess. It was more like reactive. So they would hear something and then react to it. And that's another important thing. Like, I've given a few clinics on this topic, and I find that a lot of students are afraid of the silence. And so like they just keep continuously playing until somebody else stops, right? But it's really important to kind of improvise with other people to learn and decide when your voice matters in that moment, you know, or I guess the better way I can put it is, you know, you have to kind of be able to hear something and know like, all right, this is my time to lay out, because that's really cool, right? It doesn't always have to be like you're adding your own voice into the mix. And that's why it's important too, I think, that people hopefully that check my book out will try and play these as ensembles. And I think from the start, it would be great for people to explore these as ensembles first, and then, move toward being able to play it as a soloist. So I think that's the what I'm intending for now, at least.
Anthony, if you don't mind, I was just going to say something you just said reminds me, but made me wonder, are there any sort of albums that you would suggest people listening to? Because you said like, you know, it's important to know when to lay out. Like, are there any contemporary improvisation albums or YouTube recordings or anything that you would suggest people look into?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess less contemporary musicians, but more just like even like the avant-garde, like free jazz stuff, like definitely checking out. I work with this guitarist in Philadelphia, Nick Milivoj, and definitely like some of his albums would be really awesome, because, him and the rest of his trio that he works with, they're called the Desertion Trio, are really great improvisers. And are able to kind of feed off each other's energy. And it's kind of really a really cool thing to watch and listen. So that would be like one just off the top of my head that I would say for people to check out.
So I'm really glad to hear what you said about the idea of people doing these as ensembles even first, because I know like my first teaching gig at a college was my percussion ensemble was myself and my one major. And by the end, I had about, you know, four other people in the ensemble and stuff, but we also had next to no gear. Like, we barely had anything. So as I was looking through the stuff that you sent us, I immediately thought, like, boom, this is like the perfect thing for that small regional university that doesn't have a lot of gear and doesn't have a lot. Like, you could do this and it could be this perfect moment in a concert to be teaching these students this, to be getting them out of their comfort zone a little bit. But at the same time, hey, if you only have a single 4 1/3 acoustalon marimba, like, dude, you could totally make this work and have it be a viable part of a concert. So I really appreciate you saying that.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad you said that too, because that's one thing that I think is really important is actually, like, if you were to have this with your and work on this with your students, for you to actually play as well, because you know, it's a really good thing to you know, to just, again, learn the trust between each other. And you know, you can even use it as a teaching moment. Like, quick side story, back when I was doing my tour and working with a lot of different people on these, I had a really awesome session with Sandbox Percussion. And you know, those guys are just amazing people and amazing musicians. And we hung out in their studio in Brooklyn, and we just improvised a bunch. And it was really cool because we had never played together before. And even after a few measures of just playing, you know, we realized that freedom was teaching us how to give each other cues, right? Like, so you can even use it as like if you were in a percussion quartet, or you were working even with like a septet of students to learn to play together, like, these could totally do that. But I also like, Brian, what you said about, you know, using them as a performance piece, because I think they all could totally stand alone as recital pieces for students, or it could be, you know, on a percussion ensemble concert. And I really hope people do that, like, after getting comfortable with them enough in the practice room that they don't stop there and they do play them. And, you know, I read Bill Kahn's book, Creative Music Making, like, cover to cover, many times. And, you know, one thing that he talks about is just constantly recording yourself. So, like, my hope is that people would play them in an ensemble and as soloists, record themselves a bunch, and then just go out and play them.
I was just going to add to that before I ask Casey's question, but I had a question by a student this week who was playing multi-piece, and it's a new setup, so, you know, it's uncomfortable. So the student asked, how do they become more comfortable? And what immediately came to mind is, you know, if you only play your repertoire, you're establishing a professional relationship with your instrument or with the music. It's much like with a person. You come in, you know, it's a framed sort of environment. You are only polite and professional, and that's it. If you want to actually be comfortable, you have to step away from that, and you have to just play the instrument, just spend time with it, just like with people that you actually like. Go have unstructured time over a cup of coffee, and you will get to know them in a different way. So go have a structured time over a cup of unstructured time over a cup of coffee with your instrument. Just explore it, and then you'll become more comfortable and be able to express yourself better, I think. But anyway, yada yada. Casey had, thank you. Casey had a wonderful question for you. He said, hey everyone, sorry I'm missing you today. Anthony, thanks for joining us, and thanks for your compositions and many, many shared improvisations. I'm curious, I've heard both opinions expressed very convincingly that improvisation is, one, very different, two, very similar, or three, very related to composition. How do you feel composition and improvisation are related? How is a musical idea deemed worthy of composition differentiated from one deemed worthy of improvisation? What do you think?
You know, I don't know that I see a difference. Like, almost every piece that I've written has developed, you know, based on an improvisation. And then what I'll do is I'll sit down and then I actually develop the idea, right? But I think that, you know, if I never sit down like to play my instrument and say, like, all right, I'm going to write a piece today. You know, I kind of will sit down and, you know, I'll play a bunch of things. And then, you know, oftentimes, like, some things come up and you know, I would like to develop them more. Sometimes, you know, I leave them for later. And more often than not, I feel like I come back to those ideas because I record myself, as obviously everybody knows, like I put these videos up almost every day of myself improvising, but I come back and I like will rehash them and make pieces out of them constantly. So I kind of think that it could just, it's just that they're, it's one and the same. You know, sometimes I would like to develop them more. Sometimes I think it's a little, it's, you know, great enough just to play it and let it be heard, you know, in a performance. But, you know, that kind of brings me to why, another reason why I started writing this book, but because I wrote this snare solo with electronics back in 2014 called Bounce. And at the end, there's this just slash notation. And it was just a spot for me to just like play during the performance. And that's kind of getting back to your question is to why I think it's kind of all the same thing, because I actually like to use improvisation in my compositions, you know, to just expand what I already had written. So it's not that one is higher than the other. Like, you know, like what I wrote is higher than what I'm going to improvise. And so I think they're the same. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, I had these slash notations at the end and in the middle section of my piece Bounce. And I thought it was cool. Like, you know, I would just play it and just improvise in that section. But then I started, when people were playing the piece, I got these emails saying like, what do I do here? You know? And so I thought, well, I wasn't expecting that. Honestly, I just thought that like people would trust that I was cool with them playing whatever, but then they weren't. So, you know, it was kind of an interesting kind of experience, you know, for that. So then I realized, maybe I should give more. And that's kind of where the book comes in. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I went in a million different directions with that, but I hope that I conveyed that basically I see them as, you know, tied.
Right. Equally valuable. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Just real.
Bill?
Yep. No, Bill. No,
Brian, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that my undergrad jazz professor was a very talented composer, arranger, and improviser. And in his his class, he would just say, improvisation is just composition in real time.
That's so awesome.
So that's, to me, that's like all, like, it absolutely is. Yeah, maybe you don't go into here, we'll make a video game reference for Ben Charles there. It's like composition yes. becomes the point where you can like pause the action and go, okay, now what do I actually want to do with this thing? So that's, I mean, I think but improvisation, yeah, it's absolutely, you're just making sounds in time that go along with what the feel is happening at that point. It's absolutely composition, I would say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No, so you go.
I was going to say, you know, that's part of why I started getting into the electronic end of things too, because it just felt like more possibilities, you know, where I could like play a few things and then I could start manipulating the sounds and processing them. And it would, you know, be able to, that was like my way of, or that is my way now, I guess, of developing those ideas on the fly. Yeah. And just real time composing. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Well, and the fact is, even another connection would be just the fact of, given the way that you've structured these kind of improv etudes that you've written, I mean, that's how we teach composition. All right, well, we're just going to, or even how we compose when we're composing as opposed to improvising. All right, well, what's my framework? What's my sandbox to work in? How big is it? What instruments am I going to use? How long do I want to be? Is there going to be a form? So you're doing the exact same thing, just now it's real time as opposed to pause, really, really think about what you want to put down. Okay, unpause, now pause again, so on and so forth.
Yeah, so that's why I think too that it's really important that people record themselves while they improvise, you know, so that they don't have to pause, you know,
right.
And they can like just play as whatever they're hearing. And then, you know, yeah, you don't have to use every single thing you improvise. If you wanted to, I'm only speaking on like if you wanted to improvise and then write a piece based on that.
Sure.
That's really awesome. Yeah.
Bill?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. So one of the projects that you've been doing is making videos for Black Swamp and featuring some of their snare drums. And so I just wanted to ask sort of your compositional process behind how you chose like the sounds that you used for specific snare drums, because it's really interesting to think about like, yeah, I'm composing a piece for snare drum, but I'm also composing a piece for a very specific kind of snare drum. And so I just wanted you to talk a little bit about the inspiration behind that.
Yeah.
I could latch on to Bill's question. If you could include, I know you have a piece called Loose Change that you had a really cool sort of charity initiative for. So if you could include that in that, I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah. Spare Change.
Spare Change. Yeah, sir.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought that up. Sure. Okay. So Black Swamp is, they're awesome people. And Tim Church actually was the one who was behind that project. That I think, Bill, you're talking about. And, you know, he reached out to me and said, we would love to send you, you know, a few drums and, you know, we would like to maybe have you improvise on them and like just showcase them and just, you know, explore them a little bit in your way. So I said, sure, that's great. And that's how the project actually started. So I started recording these videos and, you know, just private that I didn't share. And I recorded myself improvising every day for a couple of weeks. And then I thought to myself, well, man, I really want to write a piece for each one of these drums. And, you know, each drum had such a distinct character, not just, you know, metals versus wood versus size, but just its actual timbre, color, and the spectrum that each drum had. You know, was inspiring to me. So through those improvisations, you know, I developed some ideas and I ended up writing a piece for the small 3.5 drum. I wrote a piece for a mid-size, I guess it was a 5x14. And then I also wrote one for their titanium Titan drum that was actually really cool. It was a 7-inch depth on that guy. And so I reached out to Tim and like everybody at Black Swamp was really thrilled with it. And, you know, they kind of really lended some good support, just backing me up. And, you know, we put the videos together. I had two really awesome friends. Jeff Messino is my the videographer that I work with a lot. And then Dave DeLizza, sound artist and designer, and we just like hung out for a day and recorded the three videos and, you know, put them out there. So I would say that my improvisation was pivotal to that. And I actually since then have shared some of those, early improvisations now that people know some of the pieces. And you know, you can totally hear why I did what I did in those pieces based on the drums that I had and the colors that were provided to me. Oh yeah, I was supposed to talk about Spare Change too, right? let me tell you about that too. So Spare Change was born out of, I was cleaning my car one day and was like, not obviously like a really, you know, cool thing to do, just you have to do it, muddling through. And I found a big bag of coins in my car. And I mean, like, it had to have been like $10 in there, right? Just from, you know, paying tolls or like, you know, having parking coins or whatever. And I just kept it in my car. But at the time I was working with a school that worked with a charity in Camden, New Jersey. And it's a rough area, really high poverty area. And so we worked with this kind of like a soup kitchen and more called Cathedral Kitchen. And I was super inspired by the people there. You know, they feed actually over 300 people a day at this place, and never turn anybody away. It's not like you have to walk to the door and say, "Oh, I can't afford my rent this week, so I need food." It's just like no questions asked. They just will give, let you come in and give you a great meal. And so at any rate, I was cleaning my car around the same time. And I found that change. So I immediately was like, oh man, that would be so cool to like be able to write a piece that I could give back to, you know, to this organization. So what I did was I just like ran in the house, dropped everything. And I started just throwing the coins on the drums. And, it just made some really cool sounds. So like sometimes, like if you scrape the coin, it would make a sound. If, there's like this one really cool moment, I think, in the beginning of the piece where you have to spin the coin for a long time and only us like percussion nerds would like get the, you know, get excited about this, but you spin the coin and as it's spinning, you basically like start doing a multiple bounce roll. And so the coin spinning, then like you emerge out of that sound into a multiple bounce roll. And it's like, it's cool. So at any rate, I like started coming up with all these sounds, and that's another one of my like pieces that incorporates a lot of improvisation within it. So that it's kind of like partially notated and partially improvised. So every time it's played, I play it differently, and every person I've heard play it plays it in their own way, which is completely different than how I play it, which I absolutely love. It's amazing.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm always looking for interesting snare drum pieces because we have our, you know, Cerrone and De La Cruz things we play, but I don't want to hear De La Cruz 9 on there. <you know? laughs> So that's definitely, I've never actually had a student do that one, but that's on, maybe because I have the title wrong. That's on my list for sure.
Maybe put some change on the drum and then have them play De La Cruz 11. Because it's so easy already, you know. I mean, it would be even easier to have to play around the coins.
Yeah, I got a student doing an graduate audition at UT, I think, next weekend. So I'll have him do that for his De La Cruz 9 for sure.
All right, great.
Oh, Tom Burritt's going to love that.
He's going to love that. Yeah.
Tell them you're welcome.
Yeah, Anthony said to. But Anthony, I wanted to take us in a different direction. Actually, we've been talking quite a bit about improvisation, but I know you did your graduate studies at Ithaca College with Gordon Stout, who is, of course, now retired. But Gordon's an absolute legend in the field, and he was a previous podcast guest, and we loved that one so much. So could you tell us about, and I know you also recorded an improvisation with him, I remember that a while back. Could you tell us about what it was like to study with this guy that's just a legend?
He's amazing. I mean, and it was the perfect place for me, in that point in my career. So, you know, when I did my undergrad at Rowan University, my teacher was Dean Witten. And he was an amazing man, amazing percussionist, but his style was very, very, strict, right? So you knew that when you were playing like your Beethoven excerpts, he was going to be breathing down your neck behind you, you know? And so I started composing later in my time at Rowan, and probably by my junior year, I was writing more pieces. And so I decided I wanted to audition for Gordon because, well, number one, Dean and Gordon went to school at Eastman together. They were a couple of years apart. So I always heard the name Gordon Stout. And then he even brought Gordon in a couple of times. We played his piece Desperate Attitudes, and, you know, we had master classes with him, and I really enjoyed his music, but I knew he was an amazing musician and composer. And since I was getting more into composition, I thought I would go study with him. And so it was kind of like such a joy for those 2 years to be around him. And, you know, he, on a regular basis, was just so kind of open to everybody's ideas. So like if I would bring a piece into him, he would definitely give me some, you know, some critique, but it was a lot of just like very, you know, warm and, you know, just like he would get out of your way. He would tell you when he needed to be there, like, but he mostly would kind of like just give you the encouragement. And that was teaching enough, like just to have him on my side and knowing that he was digging what I was doing, was like enough of motivation to keep doing what I was doing. And then also, you know, I used to just walk by his office during the day and just hear him either practicing or improvising things. And then I would see him with his, you know, pencil and paper. He'd be like composing as he was improvising. So just to see, you know, how he even used improvisation as a tool to compose, and writing so many amazing pieces for the instrument in that way was also really, really a cool thing to see firsthand.
Yeah, Gordon reminds me so much of there was a professor at UNT named Sriji that I'm sure Brian knew as well. Wonderful, wonderful Indian music professor. And we had Sriji on as a podcast guest, and Sriji had like the most like amazing analogy. He said, think about a monkey and a cat and their babies. So the monkey is swinging from branch to branch and all the babies are clinging tightly to them. And that's how the monkey parents. The cat just walks and the kittens just sort of follow along. And if one gets too out of line, they grab that one and bring it back in line. But it's very open style of parenting. And Gordon Stout is definitely the second one. it's just like, because I visited it a couple of times. I had a friend that did her master's degree there, and I played on a couple of her recitals. But, I mean, it's just everyone's just in their own world doing their own thing. And all, I mean, it's not like anyone's, like, slacking off because of it, but they're just, you would expect all of Gordon Stout's students to only be playing Gordon Stout pieces and be, studying to become the next Gordon Stout. And that is not at all the case. I saw people playing, you know, huge multi-percussion setups that completely surrounded them. And I don't think anyone's ever seen Gordon Stout play multi-percussion. It's just not, you know, he's known as a marimba player. So I was just so blown away by the variety, but the sort of love of the craft and the respect for the grandmaster there at Ithaca.
Absolutely.
We have one more question from Casey. By the way, Anthony, you've already answered all of Carly's questions. She also said hi and sorry that she can't be there, but you have already spoken so well about all the improvisation and your new book, so that you've already answered everything telepathically. You knew what she wanted to know. So Casey said to anyone in the call, similar to his previous question, how do you listen differently to a performance that you know is completely composed versus one you know is completely improvised?
Mm. So me particularly? Well, I think that when I go, let's just say, let's talk about like just a free jazz concert, right? We go in there knowing that everything is going to be, you know, made up, so to speak, on the fly and then developed. But like, I feel like I go in there, the best way I can put it is I go into something like that, knowing that I'm in really good hands, in that people that know how to take their music in different directions. So like, I'm just going and I'm going to jump along and be in on for the ride, right? I'm just going to be there and see where it takes me. But as opposed to like a piece that I know maybe already, a marimba solo, or if I'm going to hear, you know, like Chike 4 or whatever, you know, I guess I listen a little bit more passively. So like because I kind of know what to expect a little bit, and, you know, still get excited about those things, but it's just a different experience. So yeah, just, I guess, passive versus active, listening. And, you know, obviously like, if you have somebody that you're going to see specifically on your instrument, like a lot of times you'll focus more on them. So like when I was a student, I would go hear the Philadelphia Orchestra all the time. And, you know, I was going to hear Don, you know, play timpani, and like, I would watch all of his things and, you know, make sure I knew what mouths he was playing and where he was muffling, as opposed to, I feel like when I go to like concerts that are, you know, all improvised, I tend to be like a big picture guy. So not to bring up like The Office, like I'm thinking like Michael Scott now, is like, you know, he's the big picture guy. So that's like what I'll do if I'm listening to an fully improv show.
I just, it reminds me so much of the topic I talked about of structure and organization. And so much of symphonic repertoire is based on large scale structure, like, you know, sonata form, or, you know, when you look at Beethoven 9, it's just a masterpiece where the last movement is a symphony within a symphony and all that sort of thing. And so to me, it's more of the idea of the beauty of the grand scale versus the beauty of the spontaneity of the moment. Because no matter what any snooty music reviewer says, there's no spontaneous Tchaikovsky 4 performance. It's all been rehearsed 1,000 times over. It might feel energetic, but it's not happening in the moment. So to me, I guess that's the difference, is it's, what am I listening to, whether it's the large scale of the piece. And I don't think that one is better or more interesting than the other. I think that no one would disagree with me that Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony could never exist as an improvisation, that it's physically impossible to get the entire violin section to just spontaneously improvise an F major scale together. It has to exist from a preconceived framework. Whereas one brilliant improviser that I can't believe we haven't mentioned yet is, do you guys know Reggie Watts?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing I love about his work is that it's almost like he has no interest in the permanence of it. Every single thing he does is exclusively an improvisation. It exists in that moment, and then it's never performed ever again. And, you know, obviously we have recordings to luckily preserve those, but go check out Reggie Watts. I think, like, the guy's a genius. I think it's every bit as legit and interesting as a Tchaikovsky symphony, but in a totally different way. And likewise, an orchestra couldn't improvise a Reggie Watts improvisation. It's just too in the moment and intricate and, I don't know, bizarre to have that many people do together. And then also another name, just while we're throwing out improviser names, is Mark Applebaum. His TED Talk, where he improvises on a Beethoven piano sonata, is just amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and it's also, it's interesting what you're saying, the idea of the macro versus the micro, talking about that when you're listening. For me, listening to an improvisation, I'm constantly questioning. I'm always wondering, like, okay, person A is playing something, and then person B comes in. Well, does it complement it? Does it go against the grain of what's going on? Okay, why did they make that? And when you see, like, this kind of, not musical harmonious, but harmonious things happening, synergistic things happening, you're like, oh, cool, like, they're really jiving with one another right now. You can see where things are connecting and maybe why this person did this. And then all of a sudden someone goes off the rails. You start to wonder that, like, all right, well, are they not listening at all? Are they in the moment? Are they consciously not in the moment? Are they like, hey, I'm going to choose to be the fly in the ointment right now. And just to kind of throw a wrench in the gear and let's just see what happens with it, you know, tear the whole thing down and see what comes of it. So it's always interesting to me hearing any improvisation to just sit there and kind of be like, what is going through that dude's head right now? And what is she thinking right now that's making her want to do this against what he's doing there or something, you know?
Yeah. Were you going to say something, Bill?
No, well, I was just going to go in a completely different path, but.
Oh, well, if you don't mind, if I can just add to that for a second. You know, and that was actually, so some questions I've been getting, because I've sent the book around a little bit, and, you know, some questions that I've gotten, and even people who have emailed me about this, like, or messaged me online, you know, has said, well, what if I'm not interested in improvisation, or if I'm not interested in playing jazz, or I'm not interested in playing contemporary music? You know, I think that there's a value to learning how to just play more freely, even if it's not actually, you know, if that's not your bag in the end game. Like, that's mine, but it's not everybody. So I read a really interesting study about how, you know, improvisation can be tied to more, you know, even just like classical music. But they did a study where they had a really amazing string quartet, professional group, play for a live audience, and they played two different versions, and the audience was supposed to score them from, you know, from lowest to highest. I think it was like just a 0 to 10 kind of a thing. And so the first time they played a movement, I think it was of a Beethoven string quartet, and they played the movement exactly how they had rehearsed it a million times, and, you know, and how it was notated, and the audience had to give them a score. And then the second time they played it, they were actually allowed to take a little bit more liberties. So they might actually pause in a place that they're not expecting. And they might actually, you know, like, change the order of sections. And then the third time, they actually were not only allowed to do that and take some, you know, standard performance practice liberties, but they were actually, like, improvising notes. So they were playing within that structure, and they were, like, you know, like, riffing on it, like almost like an electric guitar solo. And every time they did this trial, there were higher results for that from the audience, that music conveyed better for the second and third performances, most notably the third one, which I thought was really interesting, because it's like, you know, well, like Ben, you were talking about not getting everybody to improvise like the Tchaikovsky, like the violin section, like that, I totally get. But it's, to me, I never thought that people would be improvising like within a Beethoven string quartet. It's like that stuff is like gospel, right? We're not going to change it. And, you know, it conveyed better to the audiences because they felt like the performers were more connected. And then, you know, they also did an analysis of the performers, and the performers said that they didn't have that same angst when they did that, the second and third versions, because they trusted each other even more. Because, you know, when you're making things up, your eyes are away from the page. So they're looking at each other, getting ready to take a cue. So they actually, like, as an ensemble, played better, and they also, you know, played more inspired, which I thought was really, really cool.
It's so funny hearing that, because I think people always say, well, what would Beethoven think about that? It's like, Beethoven's dead. It doesn't matter.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree exactly with...
Like, I mean, like, obviously, I'm not saying we just bastardize everyone's music, but yeah, I mean, Beethoven was experimental in his day, and I think that he'd be okay with people experimenting to a certain degree. We're not, you know, it's within the spirit of what he did, and like, I mean, Bach's works are just gospel, and we, you know, but Bach improvised. That's what he did. And if you're not ornamenting Bach, you're actually probably playing it wrong. And either way, like, Bach is dead. He's not going to come back and tell you, like, why'd you put a trill there? If he does, let me know. I'll correct myself later. But sorry, Bill, I think you had something.
No, I'm actually going to piggyback on your point. Like, I think some of the most fun that I've had as a classical performer is whenever I get a chance to do something like the Hallelujah Chorus. You know, those, you get those chances in like that Baroque style to ornament and do a little bit of improvisation. You know, like the last two measures of the Hallelujah Chorus are completely improvised within the structure, of course. But it's a shame that classical music, you know, once we got to the high Baroque and into the classical era, started to get away from that whole improvisation culture, and we kind of lost something. And so, you know, as somebody who plays primarily classical music, I think it's really, really exciting when we get to go back and play some Handel, some Royal Fireworks music, things like that. It's like, oh boy, I get to like play a couple little embellishments here and there that makes it super interesting for me, and I'm going to nerd out on it. Nobody else in the audience is probably going to care, but man, I'm having such a fun time doing it.
That's so awesome. I have a question. I think you'll probably be able to answer. I remember not that long ago, several months ago, Dave Herbert played something, I think Haydn 103.
Yeah.
And was it the conductor asked him to improvise an introduction or?
Yeah. So the notation for that is just basically it's a roll, and it's a roll with a fermata on top of it. And in some later editions, you'll have like the hairpins as well. It might have been that Haydn was after the timpanist to play a little solo, like a few bars solo, kind of in the spirit of, and so that's become more of a standard performance practice with that piece, rather than just simply doing a roll that goes up and down. Now you're asked to do maybe a little bit of improvisation. And David actually, I think, used like themes within Haydn 103. Some people have also used themes that Haydn used in one of his masses that he wrote around the same time. So there's a lot of different really cool ways you can approach it. And again, it's something you can nerd out on as a classical musician, dipping your toe into improvisation.
What did Haydn think of that performance?
Who knows, right? Who knows?
You know, actually, that's something I would like to piggyback off of too. Just like, because of your experience, you know, primarily playing orchestral music, like I feel like a lot of people, at least to me, like say about like just, oh, well, I'm a classical musician. I don't need to improvise, or like I don't want to improvise. So I feel like that's the one thing that I would love to see in years to come, like that we can break out of just like this pigeonholing of like, you know, well, I was a classical percussion major at a university, so I can't play jazz, or like I won't play jazz, or I won't play rock, or I won't play whatever. Like, I wish we could all just like play whatever. I mean, we can, but I wish more people weren't afraid to just play anything they feel like, you know? So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, just in general.
Well, I think part of the issue also starts at the school, the primary and secondary school level too, where you constantly have all of these competitions and things. You don't have time in the curriculum to devote to things like improvisation in many of the schools. So I think if we started to introduce it even very early on with early childhood music going on through middle school and high school, then they're going to be less afraid to try it.
Yeah, definitely.
I was just going to draw a parallel. I don't know if any of you have gone to any of like theater improv shows, but they're brilliant. You show up and the people that are on stage are so open and they wait for input from you. So they have no idea what topic you're going to give them. So you yell something out and the principle that they have to work with is, okay, improv is yes and. The answer to everything that you get on stage or from the audience is yes and. And I think we could do something very similar in music where, of course, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to learn idioms necessarily, you know, sit down, study them and then go try to perform them. You can just sit down with your friends and be like, throw me something. Okay, do a paradiddle on a wall or whatever. Okay, I'll do that. Then somebody else has to respond to that. So I think that's what makes the narrative of improvisation so unexpected and so interesting, because we're all, the performers are constantly attuned because they don't know where this is going and they have to be responding with yes and, as opposed to, you know, written piece where you know the story from beginning to end. You're just trying to deliver it in the most beautiful or impactful way. And I think it's just a cool thing.
You mentioning that, yeah, there was a, and I think I've mentioned this before, but there was a Patton Oswalt's interview where he was talking about studying at Second City, and all those improvisers were basically taught your job is to make everyone else funny. So that's why if you look, he said, like he brought up, you look at Ghostbusters, where all those guys had kind of trained through that. Every scene, you almost never know exactly the focus, because if the camera is on Bill Murray, when Dan Aykroyd delivers a line, it's totally to try and, you know, prop up what Bill Murray is doing. But then Bill Murray is doing his thing to get Dan, to get him. That, and so it's just constantly passing of the torch. And if even if the focus is on me, I'm focused on you, actually, and vice versa.
You know, that'd be a fun thing to try and organize at a school, would be like this little improv group for musicians to come in and do sort of like an improv theater, but based on like little different compositions and stuff, you know, whether it's like the Fluxus Notebook stuff, whether it's the stuff that Anthony's doing. That'd be pretty fun.
All right. So I have to bring it up. I'm so happy you said this. So actually, before I wrote this book, and I have these on. Yeah. So I have these cards. So, and that's how those, remember I told you that I went and improvised with Gordon and with Jay and like with a bunch of other people. And so I developed these cards and it might say like, pick a scale, or it would say, you know, like set a time limit, or it might say, make gestures, or it could say rhythmic, right? And like, I would put them in a can and then we would just shake them up and pick three or four of them, and then we'd have to improvise based on that. And that's how all of those were. And so I've done that in all of my clinics since then, actually. So like the last one, I went out to NYU and I did the improv clinic there. And, you know, I think there were maybe 20 students or so, and we did group versions of that and also chamber versions. So I had them like devise like small chamber ensembles, and each group, they could pick any instruments they wanted. And then they'd have to have like, I think I had each group pick three or four cards. And so they had to like perform for the rest of the group, the rest of the class, you know, based on those four cards. And you could totally see like their antennas were up the entire time, as opposed to, you know, again, because they don't know where it's going, as opposed to them, you know, just reading along with the music and, you know, tapping their foot or like nodding, whatever. It was really, really cool.
Did you make the audience aware of what the words on the cards were, or were they just kind of like in the background?
We did. So they had to announce it, the four terms first. And they actually, my idea cards are actually available for a free download on my website as well. So if you want to check them out and do your own versions, have at it.
Cool. All this talk reminds me, I think it was maybe Anthony that said a while back, like, it's such a shame that in a sense, like improvisation died and for classical musicians anyway. And I was like, I'm like racking my brain to try and figure out when that happened, because like we said, Bach was obviously an improviser and was known for that. And when you go through classical music, and I think honestly, it's, in my opinion anyway, I think it was Gershwin's fault, because George Gershwin, great, you know, American songbook writer, jazz musician, early jazz musician of sorts, but also extensively worked in classical music and went to go study with Ravel. There's an interesting story about that. He went to study with Ravel, and Ravel told him, why would you want to be a second-rate Ravel when you could be a first-rate Gershwin? And Ravel refused to teach him. But so Gershwin wrote these, like, you know, beautiful jazz tunes and all, and he wrote them down. And all of a sudden, I think that broke the path into two separate paths, where you had people that played jazz and you had people that played classical music. And they were two different things that emerged out of Gershwin. And like Rhapsody in Blue, Gershwin would have, I'm sure, improvised all the cadenzas, but 99% of performances now, people just play the stuff that Gershwin wrote. I know Shelley Berg, who's the dean of the University of Miami, just played it at Fort Worth, which I was out of town. Unfortunately, I couldn't see it, but he played at Fort Worth, I think New Year's Eve or Christmas Eve, something like that. But Shelley, being a great jazz musician, improvised all of the cadenzas in Rhapsody in Blue. But yeah, I think it's funny, like I hate to like point to a fantastic, you know, hero musician of all of ours, George Gershwin, and say that he did something wrong, but it feels like Harry Partch, you know, saying that Bach was the worst musician of all time. And like, I don't think that, but like Harry Partch raised some good points about how Bach sort of ruined music for the rest of us. And I think that I love Gershwin and I'm not accusing him of anything. And I think it's probably our fault more than Gershwin's fault, but in a sense, to me, that's where music starts to diverge into these two unfortunate paths that I wish hadn't happened. Is that like offensive for me to say?
You're going to be editing a lot of this.
Yeah, good luck. No, I'm not trying to just like, you know, crap all over his legacy. And like I said, I don't think Gershwin intended that at all. I think that he wrote these things down, and I think that people just lost the spirit of his music and started playing exclusively what he wrote rather than, you know, playing the spirit of his music. I hope I didn't offend anyone. I don't mean that to be like a, it's not a rant. It's just a, just a thought.
Ira Gershwin too? Do you hate Ira Gershwin too?
No, Ira's my best buddy.
Okay.
All right, so wait, I'm not familiar with this. Why did Parch say that Bach was the worst musician? I don't know this at all.
Oh, so
give me the Cliff Notes version.
Toward equal temperament.
Okay.
Parch thought that the beauty of music was in the overtones and like the human vocal qualities to it, and he said the fact that Bach just, you know, mathematically, sort of scientifically went about all this, it just destroyed all of music. Yeah, so
that makes sense.
I like Harry Partch and I also like J.S. Bach, and I don't think you have to hate one to like the other, but I think it's an interesting point, and it's why Harry Partch's music was so divergent in a different and unique way. Well, now that we've just completely ruined music, I think that might be a good point for us to wrap.
Wow. Don't rope me into your thing.
Okay, before we wrap, does that make sense what I'm saying? Is everyone like following me? Like, I'm not trying to just like say that Gershwin was a bad musician. Like, in fact, quite the opposite. I think that we oftentimes lost the spirit of Gershwin's music, and no one's agreeing with me. No one's nodding. I'm just digging a hole. Brian, you're a composer. Say something.
I can see where you're coming from. I don't know. I would think that if you were going to go to where improvisation started to, for lack of a better term, die away in classical music, if that's kind of what we're talking about, I would think that it would just be as it got a bit more analytical and as the harmonic framework of things started to get more and more involved, it just became more and more difficult for improvisers to be able to hang with that, if you will. That would be my...
Yeah.
My take on it.
And obviously this is post that whenever that split was, but at the same rate, I mean, like jazz harmony got so far beyond, I think, quote unquote, classical harmony, and people improvised in that still.
This is true.
So, yeah.
I think it is kind of what we mentioned before too. It's just more things to learn, whether it be skills or repertoire, more requirements and less time. You know, I think that it's really hard for people to find time you know, to practice things that, like, on the surface, like, they might not see them as useful right away, right? These are useful skills that you're going to develop, you know, over a long period of time to be able to apply them in the situation, whether that be an improvised situation or, you know, even just shaping a line on the fly. I mean, you know, let's face it, like people even, you know, will shape lines, you know, in the practice room and do that on this on stage. So I even think that like learning how to improvise freely and just, you know, I guess playing what you're hearing and actually like playing what you're hearing with conviction, you know, can translate to anything. And that's something that you know, it takes practice to actually do. And that's also why going, you know, like tying it back into like some of the questions earlier about like, is like one, is composition and improvisation equal, you know, and I think like, it depends on the person too, right? Like if you're listening to a very skilled improviser, someone who's had a life, you know, time to practice that, their improvisations will be so much different than somebody who's brand new at it. So like to be able to apply these things to written music or not, you know, takes practice. And that's what we need to encourage. And that's what I hope to encourage people to do in this is like, I kind of see my book being like, you know, people's nudge, right? As like this, you can use this, take 15, 20 minutes out of your practice session. And this is like your safe place to create something.
Yeah, and I think also at the end of the day, like this whole thing is like an interesting point of discussion for me. But it's like we don't need to like analyze and like pick a point in history when improvisation got separated from classical music or anything. And there's certainly like Leonard Bernstein, I think you could consider a spiritual successor to Gershwin, and Bernstein was definitely an improviser of sorts and could hang with jazz musicians, but also lived in the classical world. So. I don't know. I just think it's interesting to have these discussions, but it's also important to not hold them as gospel. And I don't know. I've got a whole like Bernstein thought right now, but I'll save that for another day. I love Leonard Bernstein and George Gershwin. I don't dislike George Gershwin, to be clear.
Anthony, you've mentioned the book multiple times. Can you plug like when is it coming out and stuff like that? Because I'm sure there's going to be people that are interested in this now.
Yeah. So actually I have already launched pre-orders over the past, I guess, 2 weeks. So pre-orders continue on until its official release date, which is on March 6th. And also I should plug it too. So if anybody is interested in it and you want to take advantage of the pre-orders, I'm giving a portion of every pre-order copy to the Animal Welfare Association of New Jersey. So that's kind of like a kind of a cool thing that I want to do to just keep trying to give back with my music as much as possible.
That's great.
Well, thanks so much, Anthony, for a wonderful podcast episode. And we will see all of you on the next one, episode 220. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.